To support Interested Anthony, check out anthonyhuhulis.com/shop. There you can find all sorts of products, from apparel to framed wall art to throw pillows. Just select the artwork you'd like, adjust the sizing, pick your colors. It's completely customizable. Just go to anthonyhuhulis.com/shop. That's Anthony, HOUHOULIS.com/shop. Thank you for your support. Today's guest is an epic one, discovered by Cecil B. DeMille on set Charlton Heston's epic film, The Ten Commandments. Kathy Garver has gone on to become one of Hollywood's most accomplished stars. Most known for her role as Sissy Davis on the CBS sitcom Family Affair, Mrs. Garver has worked with the likes of Ron Howard, Charles Laughton, Julie Andrews, Chuck Norris, and Anne Hathaway, in addition to her co-stars Brian Keith and Sebastian Cabot. She studied at London's Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts, where she portrayed Juliet in Romeo and Juliet before returning to UCLA to earn her master's degree. She's been a part of Academy Award-winning films and Emmy-nominated shows, and if there's any time left for an interview after that intro, I'd like to use that now. Kathy Garver, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. My pleasure, Anthony.
So I want to rewind the clock back to when it all started. A lot of people know the Ten Commandments story, but most people don't know your first movie was actually directed by Charles Laughton. What was that experience like? And do you think actors make the best directors?
Well, you know, they really add a different dimension to it. This was his first and last directorial duty. But I think that they understand the actor. And it was surprising to me because usually when I do anything, the director never tells me anything as an actor. They are so concentrated on their vision of the entire project and let's put the camera here and let's put the camera here, maybe do a close-up, let's angle it, let's shake the camera a little or whatever. And I think maybe it's just because they hire a professional experienced actor and they kind of leave them to their own devices as to the emotionality and what they want to get out of the scene. Well, Charles Laughton had his own vision. And what happened on Night of the Hunter, and when the reviews came out, they were not good. And I think one of the reasons this movie that starred Shelley Winters and Robert Mitchum and Lillian Gish and Billy Chapin, and I mean, it was really a wonderful cast. And it was ahead of its time. It was done in this kind of German expressionistic thing of black and white and haunting music and different things like this. And it was a very scary movie with the preacher and the reverend. And what happened to the movie? Now it is considered in the top 100 of the best horror movies ever made. Mm-hmm. And it came into its own, and it is revered as one of the best pictures. I actually made a speech at Brigham Young University to their film things. And what they were assigned to do and to analyze was Night of the Hunter.
Huh. Wow, interesting. Yeah, it's amazing how films can take a new life of their own years after they first came out. I think It's a Wonderful Life was like that, if I remember correctly, too, where only because the copyrights had lapsed, that TV stations could get it for free. And so everyone started seeing it on television at Christmas time and it became a hit, but it wasn't when it was in cinemas. It's always interesting, the life of movies after the fact.
Yes, I never knew that about It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
That's interesting too. We are having a very interesting conversation, Anthony.
So that movie on the top 100 horror films of all time, Ten Commandments on the top 100 films of all time. What was your first experience like with Cecil B. DeMille and with Charlton Heston?
My experience was I was just hired as an extra on the movie because this was one of my first things. And my agent actually had some of her young girl talent in the movie, Mimi Gibson, etc. So anyway, I walk onto the set and there's donkeys and oxen and camels, and I'm placed in this little rickety wagon, and we are in the Exodus scene, And I'm one of the hordes of extras that are getting out of town and getting out of Egypt and going to find our own life. All of a sudden, I hear this thing that came over one of those great big microphones. Don't let that little girl's face get in the camera. And I said, who is that? Is he talking to me? Is that God? We were doing the Ten Commandments, but it was actually Cecil B. DeMille, and he was on this big crane overseeing it. And so the AD came, put a little blanket in front of my face, and they continued with the scene. When the scene was over, he descended, Cecil B. DeMille, from his crane, and he came over, and AD got me off the wagon, and we're chatting. And then the next thing you know, I know, and then anyone knew, and now you know, Cecil B. DeMille wrote scenes into the movie between Charlton Heston and me. Wow. Now, he was wanting to do that because of these great big epics, and this is what made them watchable and relatable, because he would pick out maybe somebody just on the spur of the moment to give it that warmer, more emotional, relatable feeling.
Interesting. That's unbelievable, because you almost, I mean, it's the one in a million of an extra. You look at a movie like The Ten Commandments, and adjusted for inflation, it costs something like $126 million. But it's in VistaVision, Technicolor, and you can tell when you watch it, it's epic. It's nearly 4 hours long. When you see movies nowadays that cost three times as much and the quality isn't there, they shot digital to save money, how has the filmmaking experience changed since the 50s and 60s, other than maybe spending more to get less? What sort of on-set differences are there between a movie that was made back then and a movie made nowadays?
Well, you know, as you indicated, that just the technology, you know, shooting on HD or shooting on some of these cameras or putting somebody in front of a green screen, it loses so much of its warmth. And I think that that's the main thing that it is lacking. And no matter what the lighting might be and how much you're warming up the costumes or whatever, it's that harder edge. And I would put up the Ten Commandments and the closing of the Red Sea, which was done with Jell-O, and the miniature little soldiers actually going through against any green screen thing that they have today for its grand, you know, it's grandeur and everything else that would go along with it. So I think that there's, you know, obviously there is a big difference.
Yeah. If that movie was your debut, let's call it, then certainly Family Affair was your star vehicle. So for the viewers that probably know, but I'll say it anyways, from 1966 to 1971, you played Sissy Davis on the hit CBS sitcom through all five of its seasons. How did that project come about? I know it was an audition, but did you know at the time how life-changing that particular role could be for you?
No, I didn't. I had been working steadily after the Ten Commandments, guest starring on TV shows, and I was a semi-regular on a television series, This Is Alice. But so I was saying, oh, well, there's a lot of nice television series that are on. But I was going to UCLA at the time, and I was trying to study and do this and the other thing. So there's a whole big story about how I got the job. But I do remember when it debuted, and I'm going down the escalator in a department store, and this person said, oh, I saw you last night. Oh, you were just so great. Oh, can I have your autograph? And I'm going, huh? Why do you want my autograph? And that concept was not particularly clear to me. Mm-hmm. And I felt a little strange giving something else. An idea just crossed my eye when my Uncle Johnny looked like Red Skelton. And totally. And someone came up and, oh, could I please have your autograph? And he said, sure. John Schmoker? Anyway. So I got used to it, though, because people said, well, it's like giving a present. Mm-hmm. So you're giving a present to somebody. And so in that way, it took the onus off of me. And I like to give people presents. I'm generous Sagittarian. And so that made it okay.
Do you miss the autograph days now with the, hey, can I get a photo of you?
No, I go before COVID. I did like an autograph convention or a Comic-Con. I've done a lot of animated series. So I go to the Comic-Cons. I go just to the regular autograph conventions. And I love it. Nancy, I really took to it like a little flea to a dog.
You know, whenever you see a new set of like young stars arrive to town, it always seems like they're in a little bit of a community, all making the rounds doing, you know, the Hollywood Reporter group photo shoots or going to Young Hollywood together. What's it like behind the scenes as an up-and-coming star in the business? Do they have you sort of doing press tours and whatnot, or were you able to kind of avoid the mayhem of all that back during the Family Affair days?
Well, it was totally different because we did everything in person rather than Zooming or being on social media with the Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and all of that. So it was more of a face-to-face social kind of thing. There's still some things that, and especially before COVID, like openings and premieres, and I do the Hollywood Museum a lot and go down the red carpet and have all of the lights in my eyes blinking. But when I was younger, I did a lot of things, you know, and a little Anissa Jones, who played Buffy, was swept away, you know, every weekend to go to a different city or, you know, appear at Toys R Us or be in a parade or, you know, do those things just as I was doing, but I was going to disco clubs and a little bit more adult kinds of fun PR things. Mm-hmm.
Was there ever a story you wanted to tell in one of those interviews prior that those pesky publicists just wouldn't let you?
Well, of course. Everyone has their secrets. And that's why they're secrets.
I'd imagine childhood stardom especially can be at times isolating and certainly a lifestyle many people can't wrap their heads around. What's something, whether a misconception or just pure ignorance, that the general public doesn't know about stardom, and more specifically, again, childhood stardom, that you wish they did?
Well, I wrote a book. I've written 5 books, but one of the books that I wrote was Ex-Child Stars, Where Are They Now? And it takes like child stars on television primarily from the 50s up to the 80s. And it isn't isolating for these kids. They are amid, you know, a big crowds of people, or when they are shooting, you have like 50 people on the set. So there are a lot of hearts and minds and souls to deal with every day. Again, like the Beatles just crossed my mind, or like someone that is doing a big stage show, they go back to their rooms in their hotel rooms. That's a different kind of things. With the children, they are, and especially now, they're very well protected. And although they have tutors on the set, you know, they don't, on the weekends, they're with their friends and their neighbors. And sometimes they're treated differently and sometimes they're not. What really is the main thing that happens with kid stars is that once they become like 12, 13, 14, they are really into their awkward age and they're not as cute. And it's more difficult for them to get jobs. And especially now with the social media, if, you know, they say, oh my gosh, did you see that horrible sweater? That red just clashed with her red hair and she was just horrible. They read that and they take it to heart as they haven't developed their identity yet. So that is such a special time, you know, 14 to 17. And it's another reason why that they don't really make it, a lot of them, as adult actors. One, they haven't taken the general lessons and learned how to be an actor. They were just cute kids. And if they could memorize their lines and go to their mark, then that was great. And the production loved it and that was fine. But then when they're older, that's all they know how to do. They memorize their lines and they go to their marks. Well, why isn't anybody hiring? Well, yeah, aren't I cute? And they use the same persona, right, that got them money and accolades. And speaking of money, that's like number two. A, they don't learn how to act, and B, their parents, and especially during my era, would take all their money. And poor Johnny Whitaker, even, he came from a Mormon family of like 7 or 8, and they tithed, and his money went for the whole family. So when he was 18, he did not really get all the money that he had so deciduously worked and earned. Dear Paul Peterson, who was on the Donna Reed Show, started an organization called A Minor Consideration to address some of these things. And he was able to get into law, the Coogan Law, where a portion of a child's pay has to be put into an especial account called the Coogan account. So when they're 18, then they at least get some money.
Wow. You know, this next question, it's funny, I had come up with before I even knew Paul Peterson did the intro to your book, or the foreword to your book, I should say, but it was just referencing him and others like him that are making strides for supporting child actors nowadays. But seeing as how spread out the landscape has become, I mean, someone can get big on YouTube and they don't necessarily have co-stars to help them deal with it, or they're not in the Hollywood system. If there was a guide for parents, a handbook, let's say, how to raise a famous child, even outside of Hollywood, what should be in that book, in your opinion?
That's really an interesting question. I would say, because it isn't just like actors. There are sports figures that are young, and some, I was just reading about one of these gymnasts that was given away really basically at 12 to a coach up in Oregon, and she got the bronze or whatever. But I would say, first, always support them, give them love, listen to them, and listen to their needs. My son, I started him, he was in SAG and he was doing this, and at 12 he says, "Mommy, I don't want to do this." Okay, I would like you to, but if you really don't want to, then you don't. Don't push the kids. I mean, because many times it's for the parents. Sure. Rather than what the child does. And of course, in my estimation, the child doesn't know, and at that age, what they want to do anyway. And so that's one thing, you know, listen to their concerns, start an account for them, give them money each week, teach them how to be financially responsible. I cannot emphasize that more, because, you know, whether it is a singer or an actor or a tennis ace or whatever, and they get millions of dollars. And that can go for rappers or whatever. Oh my gosh, here's $1 million. I'm going to buy a new house and I have a new car now. And now I'm going to, you know, do all of these things. And they have not learned to figure out how to, you know, take care of their finances.
Yeah, potentially make that lump sum money last the rest of their life if they have to.
Yeah, you know, and do other things. So, and investments, et cetera. So giving them some money every week that's theirs and they can do. And then they learn that, oh my gosh, I don't have any more money. Ma, no, this is how much you were given this week. I can't give you any more money. So then they, well, can I cut down this tree? Or, you know, gee, I'll make you dinner tonight. And they learn to work for their money. Yeah. Oh, what a concept. So those are some of the things I certainly would put into the guide.
You were talking about, you know, certain actors only know how to hit their marks and say their lines. You, on the other hand, as I mentioned in the intro, studied at London's Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. It seems to me, personally, there's a great emphasis placed on fame in Hollywood, whereas the focus across the pond is on craft. Would that be a fair assessment?
Yes, absolutely. I think there was just a survey taken, and they said, well, what do you want most in life in America? To be famous. That was their number one thing, and it wasn't even to make money. It's just that they wanted to be famous. I have been thinking lately that there are so many people in the world. You know, where do you find your identity? Because I'm thinking, why do people get tattoos and do all that? They want to stand out. They want to be, this is who I am. Or they join a group. This is who I am. Because the pressure is so much to find, I minored in psychology at UCLA, but to find, you know, the core person of who you are and, mm-hmm. and who you can be. And I definitely, I agree with you like 100%. that the craft in England is just great. And I was very happy. I went to the Royal Academy. And then when I came back to get my master's in theater arts at UCLA, you know, it was different. We were looking at scenes and studies, but it was a lot of Uta Hagen and Stanislavski rather than figuring out the scene, analyzing the scene, doing that, and then letting yourself go. So you can blend the two.
Sure. It's funny. I discovered Family Affair maybe a month or two ago, and I binge watched the entire thing in about a month. It's just so comforting. So I have a couple of questions in regards to that show. You know, many comedy shows such as King of Queens or Seinfeld, they have finale seasons that are distinct, where the episode by episode breakdown goes into a longer story arc, maybe leading out to closing out all the characters' arcs in like a finale. And Family Affair never got that opportunity. How were you told the show wouldn't be continuing, and how did you feel about it? Because it never had its ratings fall off. It was just kind of canceled one day. How did you feel about that?
Well, you know, I accept most everything that happens. Oh, well, that is over. That was really fun. What am I going to do now? We were told, and I think that I found out, I don't know how, I don't even remember, but I do know that they were trying to go to take it to ABC, mm-hmm. because CBS, which was its home, was changing its whole direction. And so instead of the wonderful, comforting sitcoms that they had, Andy Griffith and Family Affair and these type of shows, they wanted more realistic. So instead of Family Affair, it was All in the Family. And let's be more realistic and everything. ABC had not changed its direction, however. So they were just about to sign on the dotted line to continue Family Affair on ABC when another show came that had more kids and had the youngest child looking a lot like Buffy, with a couple ponytails, and she even had a doll. And Susan Olsen, she even says, yeah, we tried to look like Buffy. So they took the new show. So that was why it was, they had wanted to continue it. And they were even thinking of adding another child to it, as they want to do. So that's why we didn't, you know, continue on. And I continued on saying, all right, now I'm going to go to Europe.
I want to delve a little further into what you were talking about, because when Family Affair was canceled, it was more of a cancellation of culture, of the family-oriented shows of the time. You think Donna Reed Show, Dick Van Dyke Show, Leave It to Beaver, Andy Griffith. Even a few years later, the Doris Day Show was canceled. What are your feelings as to the choices the industry made in the 70s regarding the portrayals of family lifestyles and wholesomeness on screen?
Well, you know, you never know whether the TV is a reflection of life, or life creates the culture. You see, this is the way that HBO and Netflix and all of those platforms started, because the networks were still under FCC and the rules and regulations, whereas there wasn't any rules and regulations. And so they could just go as far as they want. They could be as violent or as sexy or depraved or deprived as they want to be, because they're not regulated. And personally, I think that is what has contributed to the spiraling down of our morality, and I swear to God, I can't find anything on TV really to watch of our 483 stations.
Yeah.
So it's, I don't think it serves the populace well, and all this cancel culture. What culture do you want to cancel? You know, right. There are tons of cultures. They're not going to cancel my culture, I'll tell you that.
Though on the flip side, now 50 years later, young people are still discovering that work for the very first time and engaging with it. How does that make you feel? Maybe there's hope?
I think that there is. There is seeking some kind of caring. I don't think people care about each other. It's difficult to care on Facebook or whatever. You say, oh, here are my prayers and here are some flowers for you, and I'm sorry that happened. It's not the same as life and blood and the exchange of energy and our electrons, et cetera, going back and forth. So it's, I think that people are looking for comfort. I have this new show at TV dinners, and it's a bite of comfort, a bite of nostalgia. It was the way it was. And I think that's the way an entertainment can serve as one of a place. I'm depressed. What am I going to do? And a half hour of comfort of saying, and losing yourself and escaping that way, instead of escaping into some sci-fi robotic thing where it's just, this, the same thing that you see around you. So I think there's definitely a place for it. There are some networks that are really thriving with, not everybody saying the F word and this and that and the other thing and slitting somebody's throat and opening them up and, whatever. And that is such a fantasy, but it becomes a reality just as the video games. And again, I think that is, one of the reasons for all the violence and things that happen.
Now, most of your interviews and press regarding your work involves Family Affair or Ten Commandments, or sometimes your books or Spider-Man or the bigger name projects. But are there any lesser known films of yours that you're very proud of and wish more people knew about?
I love this movie I did called Mom, Murder in Me. And it was a comedy, and I played the mother, and it's a mystery. I love mysteries. And we're going to find out what actually happened and who the culprit is. And there's like car chases and running, and it's lots of fun. And it's on the screen, and it was an independent film. Mm-hmm. I like these independent films. And this Old Man Jackson that I just did in Houston is really, it's a romantic comedy in a way with a very nice arc. And it was, some of these lesser known ones really are more touching.
On a film like, or any of these independent films, I should say, obviously they come with their limitations, but it seems like the limitation of the bigger budget films is they need to play it safe and sell as many tickets as possible. Do you feel you have more, not more range, but less limitations in terms of the acting on a small independent film? You can take it more places. You don't have to play it as safe.
Absolutely. You can just be so much more creative. There was like even a stipulation, I don't know if this was still intact, that when you were doing like a TV show or whatever, the writer was right there. God forbid you should change one word. And that's okay, that this is my line and I'm saying it exactly right. Saying this is my line and well, I sure hope I say it right. There's a lot of difference. I usually improvise all my scenes anyway, and then I put it back into its casing. But I definitely do. And it's there's much more of a team feeling and helping each other out where, nope, you can't move that chair, that's my job. Nope, you don't adjust that light. You move that 1 inch, that prop. I'm the prop person. I move it 1 inch. Give me a break.
Yeah. It gets back to the true kid in you of let's all make a movie together and not the hierarchy necessarily of the big budget shoots.
Yeah, and it should be. I mean, that's what a lot of creativity is about. So many people just lose that because they become encapsulated and they say, I'll have to do this right. I can't move my head, or whatever.
Can you, with all these films, can you watch them as a normal viewer, or can you not fall into the story? You can only see the memories of what it was like that day on set or other thoughts you have associated with that project. Or can you watch one of your pieces of work and actually get involved with the story?
Not usually. not even Family Affair. I watched and I said, I remember that dress. I really like that dress. That was good. I remember that. Brian really didn't like that actor when he was on the set. So my mind is just, going around what happened. And besides, I already know the story for those. Yeah. So I know the story. So then it just recalling all the fun stuff that went into making it.
Do you think in this new climate of digital independent that you can get by just being a creative, or do you think you need to treat yourself like an entrepreneur running a small business?
It's an interesting question. I tend to think that you can just be a creative because there are so many platforms and there's so many things. If you're willing to work for $100 a day or $125 a day, non-union or whatever, and that will suffice, then you can spend your time on building your career and getting more jobs and bigger and better jobs. If you have, you know, not everybody can be an entrepreneur. Not everybody can be a business person. There are some people just have no idea what a checkbook or, you know, what Venmo is or PayPal or Zelle or whatever. But then again, there are the people that I didn't really start being a producer until maybe 10 years ago. It was all acting. However, in that acting realm, I've done pretty much all of it. You know, it takes an incredible amount of work.
Thank you so much for your time. You're a friend of the show. Welcome back anytime.
Thank you.
For our listeners, at the time of this recording, you can find Family Affair for free on Tubi and Amazon Prime Video. You can pick up a copy of Kathy's books, Ex-Child, Stars, Where Are They Now?, and Surviving Sissy, My Family Affair of Life in Hollywood on Amazon, Barnes & Noble's, Apple Books, and just about everywhere else books are sold. I even saw a few copies in my local library. You can check out her website at kathygarver.com and find her on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Kathy, it's been a pleasure, and I wish you continued success and happiness. Thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you, Anthony.